Great Hunters, a sci-fi space opera, written by Gary Kaufman, read and produced by Andrew Kaufman. For more information about the author, book, or podcast, visit www.kaufmansci-fi.com. Ladies and gents, and everybody else here not sitting on a cushion, welcome back to the Great Hunters Podcast. I'm Andrew Kaufman, your host. And I'm going to make this one short and sweet, as we have over 33 minutes of story to bring to you today, and I don't want this episode to be too long. So, without further ado, here is the story so far. When we last saw our heroes, Jane was working up the courage to let Mr. Matthias know about their plans for making a small alteration to the human male germline in order to tamp down on aggressiveness and tribalism. Taken aback by her rather massive idea, Mr. Matthias thought about it overnight, and the next morning he gave her permission to get started, letting her, and subsequently her team, know that if they were caught, the very nature of the project would force Matthias to disavow all knowledge of it. Immediately after, four began to throw themselves into the endeavor, searching and finding a candidate virus to deliver their very small payload, calling it Virus Y for simplicity's sake. Then things began to move relatively quickly. They engineered Virus Y to carry the RNA into male reproductive cells, which caused the male rats they tested it on to become far less aggressive. Even better, after being allowed to breed, the offspring of the rats also carried the less aggression tendencies. Subsequent testing, including Walt and Art purposefully infecting themselves, revealed there were no apparent side effects, and the virus would not transmit to females. Once they, and Mike, the alien exobiologist, further confirmed the results, they began manufacturing the virus on a near-industrial scale in the basement of the Matthias Institute. Looking at methods of distribution, they decided on using the Virusphere, a system of air currents a few kilometers up that held and sent virions, viruses with protective protein shells, all over the planet, using the northern and southern jet streams. Meanwhile, Mike received some rather disturbing news. His old mentor, Professor Ellisbach, was coming out to visit. Dread settled into Mike's soul, fearing that he would soon share in the fate of his old friend Garwig, a former fellow exobiologist that had been planted for interfering in a planet's development, nearly identically to what Mike had just done. Seeing that Ellisbach would arrive in about 10 years, Mike began to get his work in order and to destroy any evidence of his meddling with the humans. Chapter 22. Art's Retirement. 8 years had passed since the four scientists changed the germline of the human male. Art leaned back in his chair and put his feet on his desk. He had spent the day emptying his file cabinets and discarding old computer printouts, documents, and journals. He had placed a few keepsakes in a small cardboard shipping box. Included in the box were a piece of Arctic tundra encased in a cube of acrylic plastic and his ancient Melita coffee pot. 4 years ago, Mr. Matthias had died peacefully in his sleep. The secret of immortality remained undiscovered, but Matthias had lived long enough to see his investment in a peaceful Earth pay off many times over. Matthias didn't have a family, and he had chosen Jane to be the executor of his estate and his successor to lead the Institute. He left everything, except his silver town car, to the Institute. The town car went to a man Jane had never heard of, Greg Black, a human resources consultant. She wondered why anyone would want that old Lincoln. Matthias was not just rich, he was truly wealthy. Jane had worked with an estate attorney to turn his wealth into a $10 billion endowment for the Institute. As specified in Matthias's will, the Institute was, quote, dedicated to the improvement of the human condition, unquote. 7 years ago, Sarah married Walt, and within another year, she gave birth to twin girls, Emily and Amy. At 6 years old, they were skinny with long legs and curly hair. Amy's was blonde and Emily's light brown. Sarah complained that her girls were always into something. They liked constructing intricate structures with Legos and doing experiments with their chemistry set. After seeing what public schools offered, Sarah and Walt decided to homeschool the twins. For their classroom, Sarah borrowed a small conference room at the Institute. Walt taught reading and math. Other Institute scientists tutored the girls in whatever topics they thought the girls might find interesting. The scientists frequently remarked on how easily the twins absorbed their lessons. The Institute psychologist said the twins' intellectual development was twice their physical development. She wondered if this was because the twins spent all their time with PhDs. Art looked up in surprise when Sarah, Walt, and Jane walked into his office. He lifted his feet off his desk and stood up. Holding a bottle of champagne, Jane said,
"Happy retirement, Art."
Art's face lit up with a big smile. He said, "Come in, sit down." Art pulled three more chairs to his desk. From a brown bag, Sarah produced three Erlenmeyer flasks.
"The best champagne glasses I could find. And I brought a can of Diet Dr. Pepper for Walt."
Jane popped the cork and poured champagne evenly into the three flasks. Jane lifted her flask and said,
"To peace."
The four old friends clinked the three flasks and the can of Diet Dr. Pepper. They still kept their secret. As a result of their work, humanity had changed. Old wars were settled by negotiation. New wars did not start. Homicide and rape had dropped to near zero. Businessmen spent more time cooperating for a common goal and less time thumping their chests and fighting their way up the corporate ladder. Political parties declined, and the number of independent voters tripled. Football viewership dropped by nearly 75%. Nations agreed to environmental improvement treaties that actually made a difference. The four had conducted the most consequential science experiment of all time, but no one else, except Mike, knew what had happened. The evidence was hidden in plain sight. 13 small changes to the 3 billion base pairs that compromised the human male genome. While the cause remained hidden, the results of the change were evident to everyone. Scholars and journalists published thousands of papers and articles documenting the decrease in war, violent crime, political gridlock, and unbridled greed. One popular explanation suggested that social fitness was responsible. Social fitness is the theory that social species such as ants, wolves, and humans evolve in response to two forces. One, a traditional Darwinian fitness, animals' ability to survive and reproduce. The other force is a social fitness, which means that members of a social species evolve in ways that benefit the survival of their species as a whole. Jane wiped her eyes, and tears rolled down Sarah's cheeks. Walt put his right arm around Art's shoulders and hugged him, and Art's eyes glistened with tears of his own. Their years of working together and their shared secret forged a strong bond. And now, one of them was leaving. Art blinked his eyes, cleared his throat, and changed the subject.
"Sarah, did you ever hear from Mike?"
"No. I sent him several emails, but nothing's ever come back. I'd love to tell him how it all went."
"I think he knows," Jane said.
"I have a feeling he does too," Sarah said. "But I'd love to meet him. Back then, we were at the leading edge of human genomic science, but Mike was miles ahead. Can't imagine what he's doing now."
Chapter 23. Professor Ellisbach. In preparation for Professor Ellisbach's arrival, Mike organized his mountains of data and wrote summary papers for her review. He brought all of his documentation up to date, except for certain changes in the human males. Ellisbach was bright, and she would notice if a war-loving species like the human suddenly stopped fighting. That would present a tempting puzzle, and she would investigate until she found the answer. Her ship, another space rock similar to Mike's, appeared on his sensors a year ago. They exchanged a few encrypted messages. Her messages continued to be guarded, just routine position updates. Mike still had no clue about why she was coming, and he was getting anxious. He needed to create a diversion, something that, when she arrived, would catch her attention and allow him to avoid a too thorough examination of his recent work. Exobiologists love unique artifacts from alien cultures, and he thought he knew what she would like. Humans listened to airborne vibrations of varying frequencies and rhythms. These vibrations gave them pleasure. Sometimes they vocalized along with the vibrations, and sometimes they danced. They called these vibrations music. Yeldman had an auditory sense, and Mike found some vibrations pleasing. However, he had not yet tried vocalizing. Given his physical structure, dancing was definitely out. Mike took a few days to design and build speakers to broadcast music throughout his ship. He didn't know if Professor Ellisbach would find the music pleasing, but he thought that she would at least find it interesting. For Professor Ellisbach, Mike chose a favorite, a vibration that Earthlings called Beethoven's Seventh. At last, alarm bells rang, and a gentle bump told Mike that Professor Ellisbach's shuttle had docked. She entered his ship, and she was as attractive as ever. He felt a warm flush deep within his trunk. However, her businesslike manner quickly chased away any hope of romance.
"Hello, Mike. Good to see you."
"Good to see you too, Professor."
"I'm sorry to interrupt your research, but I have bad news."
Apprehensive to start with, the words "bad news" sent an electric shock through Mike. Somehow, she had discovered his contact with the humans. But instead, Ellisbach said,
"Large harvester fleet is headed towards this planet."
These words brought a new fear, one that eclipsed his fear of being discovered several times over. He could not have imagined worse news. The harvesters were a long-lived species like his own, but they hunted and gathered instead of being scientists and explorers. They traveled from planet to planet, looting resources and enslaving intelligent species to support their empire. The Eldmen went out of their way to avoid discovery by the harvesters. This explained Ellisbach's in-person visit and her limited communications. The less the Eldmen broadcast, the less chance the harvesters would discover them.
"How long?"
Mike asked.
"About 50 Earth years."
Mike despaired, but he tried to show only disappointment.
"I understand. Thank you for the warning. I will wrap up my research." "Just to be safe, I want you on your way home in no less than 45 years."
He agreed without protest. If the harvesters discovered him, they would capture and torture him until he divulged the location of Erdiu. Mike asked,
"Will you be able to stay a while?"
"Sorry, Mike. I must warn a colleague of yours in the Alpha Centauri system."
With a quick
"goodbye and good luck,"
she returned to her shuttle and left. Chapter 24. An Invitation. Mike was horrified at what was sure to happen to the humans. Now, when they needed every bit of their aggressive destructiveness and tribalism, these traits were shadows of what they once were. The harvesters will crush the Earth's defenses like a wrecking ball dropped on a China teacup. And it was all his fault. The thought was nearly unbearable. He wrapped all 8 tentacles around his trunk and played Beethoven's Seventh to calm himself down. But it was useless. He had broken the no-contact rule, and by doing so, he had set the stage for the subjugation of the humans. What a disaster! In search of a distraction, Mike opened his link to the Earth's internet once again. He had not done this in years and saw several old messages from Sarah. After she and her colleagues had launched their weather balloons, he had withdrawn from further contact. However, Sarah had continued to write.
"Mike, I haven't heard from you in ages. Is everything okay? Mike, I'm attending the October Human Genetics Conference in Paris. Will you be there? Maybe we can meet in person. Hi, Mike. Please write."
"I should write," Mike thought. "I've already broken the no-contact rule. Shattered would be a more accurate word. No reason to hold back now. If the Earth is to have a chance to defend itself, I'll have to be like Jane and act. This time I'm going to need to do more than nudge the humans along. I've got to do all I can to help with their defense."
He wrote,
"Greetings, Sarah. Please accept my apologies for not writing sooner. My reasons have nothing to do with our relationship, which has been quite pleasant. Instead, well, things are somewhat complicated. We do need to meet, but I won't be able to come see you. That would cause far too many problems. Instead, I want to send a vehicle for you. I assure you, it is safe. You're welcome to bring Jane along. I feel as though I know her through our correspondence. The reason I'm asking you to visit is quite dire. I have hard evidence that an alien hunter-gatherer species that we call the Harvesters has targeted the Earth. They intend to enslave humans and take the Earth's resources for their empire. We may have enough time to prepare a defense, but this is going to require luck and serious effort. I look forward to hearing from you soon. Mike.
When Sarah saw an email from Mike, she was delighted and quickly opened it. However, as she read its contents, horror began to replace her delight. She sat unmoving at her desk, reading and rereading the email. After a few minutes, she printed the email and went looking for Jane. Once she found her, Jane read the email and asked skeptically,
"An alien invasion?"
"You think I should go?"
Sarah asked.
"Sarah, you've never met him. You don't know anything about him. And you're going to be picked up and taken to Lord knows where. This doesn't make sense."
"I know, Jane."
Sarah rubbed her temples with her fingers.
"But what if he's right? The future of humanity could be at stake, and you're worried about a blind date."
"Of course I'm worried. That's why I'm going to go with you."
"I'd like that,"
Sarah responded. Jane said,
"Let me make a few arrangements. The Institute mostly runs itself, but it wouldn't do for me to just disappear."
Then Jane asked,
"What about Walt?"
Sarah grimaced.
"You'll have to stay with the twins. What should I tell him?"
"Tell him you're going to meet with Mike about an alien invasion,"
Jane said.
"God, that's not going to sit well with Walt. You'll have 1,000 questions, and I don't have any answers."
"All right. Tell him we're going to a top-secret CIA conference, and we'll have no phone or internet access."
Sarah looked dubious.
"Are there such things?"
"Sure. Anything to do with national security works that way. No leaks, no eavesdropping."
"Oh, Jane, this is wild. I haven't been this excited since we changed them in."
Sarah wrote back to Mike.
"Great to hear from you, Mike, and I look forward to meeting you in person. However, your email was very shocking, to say the least. Aliens coming to invade the Earth. I told Jane about your offer to meet, and she said she wanted to come with me. We'll need to make some preparations before leaving. Would 1 month from today be okay with you?"
Chapter 25. Road Trip. Mike didn't want Jane and Sarah to be too shocked when they arrived, so he decided to send some additional information. "I'm pleased you and Jane are coming for a visit. However, you should know a few things about me and my situation. I am not human. My species calls itself the Eldman, which means long life in our language. We have named our planet Erdiu. I am an exobiologist, and my job is to study species on other planets. I've been in orbit around the Earth for some time, long enough to be concerned, as you were, that the males of your species would destroy the planet. Please be assured that the shuttle vehicle I will send for you is safe. It is substantially safer than taking a commercial airline flight. You should pack for 4 days and bring warm clothes. The shuttle may be a bit cooler than what you're used to. I will provide sleeping accommodations and, hopefully, adequate nutrition. But I suggest bringing some of your favorite foods just in case my synthesizing proves inadequate. My shuttle will arrive at the Institute on June 15th at 04:30. I look forward to meeting you both in person. Mike." Mike realized he had a great deal to do to get ready. Fortunately, the Eldmen can divide their brains into independent parts and work on things simultaneously. Mike split his brain into 3 parts. To one part, he assigned the job of reconfiguring the outside of his shuttle. It was designed for emergencies, basic utilitarian model with an anti-gravity drive for landing and departing from planets, and a small fusion drive for space travel. But landing it on the Earth would attract unwanted attention, and it needed to be disguised. The passenger compartment also needed to be redesigned. Sarah and Jane needed comfortable places to sit and lie down. Since he did neither, this could easily be overlooked. He assigned this work to the second part of his brain. To the third, he gave the job of creating the necessities for a reasonably comfortable flight, temperature control and air purification, a waste disposal facility, and sufficient food and water. After the design work was complete, Mike put his synthesizers and 3D printers to work, creating the essentials for what he hoped would be a comfortable, discreet trip. With all that going on, he nearly forgot. He needed to be able to speak to Sarah and Jane in their language. He had learned to read English centuries ago while observing the United Kingdom, but he had never spoken a word of it. He needed a good source of spoken English that he could emulate. He began to search through television broadcast channels and quickly chose BBC One. It had humans speaking English 24 hours a day and closed captioning. After reviewing all the shows, he decided to copy the calm, deep voice of a reporter who covered business news. He hoped this would put Sarah and Jane at ease. The month passed quickly, and soon it was the afternoon before they were to leave. Sarah and Jane walked through the Institute parking lot to their cars. Jane asked,
"Tell me again, why do you believe Mike?" "He knows things about genetics that no one on Earth knows."
"Okay, what else?"
"He's trying to help us. His suggestions were right on target, and I think he's telling the truth."
"You think this trip is worth the risk?" Jane asked.
"If what he said is true and we ignore him, what's the downside?"
"Aliens take over the Earth. All right, see you tomorrow at 0400.
The following day, at 0430, a shiny black Cadillac Escalade rolled to a stop in front of the entrance to the Matthias Institute. Sarah and Jane opened the Institute's front door and walked down the steps. Even though it was summer, they wore jackets and wool slacks, and they each carried a suitcase and tote bag with bottles of water, breakfast bars, dried fruit, peanuts, and beef jerky.
"Sarah, this is insane. We're going to space in an SUV?" "I know, and I've got two kids and a husband at home."
"This better not be a scam."
Jane patted her jacket pocket, making sure she had brought her .38 special snub-nosed revolver. As they approached the Escalade, the passenger doors opened. In his friendliest voice, Mike said, "Welcome, Sarah and Jane. Please, come aboard." The voice was deep and pleasant, and had a British accent. Jane looked at Sarah, one eyebrow raised in surprise. In a whisper, she asked,
"Mike's a Brit?"
They peered into the vehicle, seeing two tall back seats with gray upholstery, several gray boxes secured by straps, and nothing else.
"Mike, are you in here? Are you the driver?"
Sarah asked. There were 3 seconds of silence, and then, "No, Sarah, I'm not in here, and there is no need for a driver. The shuttlecraft is fully automated. However, I will be in voice contact. Please, sit down and buckle your seatbelts." Sarah climbed in and sat on what felt like a suede upholstered recliner. She said,
"Comfortable seats, Mike."
Once again, there was a 3-second pause, and then, "Thank you." Mike was glad she liked the seats. He had never made a chair. Extrapolating from regular automobile seats, he had added extra padding, made them recliners, and covered the seats with a soft fabric. Jane cautiously climbed in, sat down, and buckled her seatbelt. She looked around at the gray, plastic insulating panels that covered every surface except the windows and seats. She said,
"Cadillac must be slipping. The interior of this thing sucks."
Sarah laughed.
"I'm so glad you're here with me."
The doors closed, and Mike said, "We will start now. Food and water are in the boxes, and a waste disposal facility is at the rear of the cabin. Our trip will last 36 hours. The Escalade rose quietly, and Sarah and Jane watched the lights on the ground recede.
"There's no engine noise,"
Jane said.
"How does this thing move?"
Mike said, "The shuttle is equipped with something you can think of as anti-gravity. It is useful for moving within the gravity well of a planet. Once we reach the altitude of 150 kilometers, the fusion drive takes over." Quick to pounce on the imprecise language, Jane asked,
"You said we can think of it as anti-gravity. But what is it exactly?"
"Ah, yes, that was rather vague. I think of it as anti-gravity, but that's not correct. As you know, gravity is not a force, but the bending of space-time caused by mass. So, there can't be an anti-gravity device, at least in the sense that it would cancel gravity. We deal with gravity by tapping into the universe's natural repellent force. Your scientists call it dark energy.
It's more efficient than the chemical combustion used in your current generation of rockets.
Good lord,
Jane mumbled under her breath.
Sarah asked,
One more question, Mike. Where are we going?
My ship is located at Lagrange Point 4.
Lagrange Point 4? Jane asked.
Sarah explained.
A Lagrange point is a location where the gravitational pull of two large bodies, in this case the Sun and the Earth, are equal. NASA sometimes places satellites at Lagrange points because they tend to stay put there.
How far away is it?
Jane asked.
L4 is the same distance as the Moon, replied Sarah.
You're kidding.
Nope. Did you notice there's a pause before we hear Mike speak? Radio waves take a little over a second to get from us to him, and the same amount of time to get back to us. Pause will get shorter as we get closer to his ship.
Jane shook her head.
This is unbelievable.
After a while, Sarah asked,
Mike, is there anything we can do during the trip? I can't just sit and look out the window for 36 hours.
I understand. The shuttlecraft has an encrypted link to my computers. I have a complete genetic analysis of over 1.7 million Earth species. I also have a reasonably good history of the harvesters. My computer will translate everything into standard English, and I thought you might pass the time by looking through my files.
You're very thoughtful, Mike,
Sarah said.
She and Jane unpacked the laptops and connected to Mike's computer. Chapter 26. The Harvesters.
Jane briefly looked at Mike's files and said,
The genomic information can wait. I want to see what Mike has on the harvesters.
Sarah said,
The more we know, the better our chances of surviving.
After a few minutes, she said,
Found it. The file is called A Brief History of the Harvesters.
Sarah propped her laptop on the armrest between herself and Jane, and they leaned together to share the screen. Chapter 1. Introduction and Early Culture. The information in this report came from a team of exobiologists who investigated a harvester battleship that had been severely damaged during an attack on M299-04. The defenders of the planet were capable fighters, and they destroyed four of the harvester's ships. This report provides only a summary of what we know. The full report and physical evidence are stored in the Central Library for those interested in more detailed information. The summary starts with a short video created by the harvesters. We don't know how the harvesters used the video. Perhaps it was educational. We have included it because it introduces the early harvester culture. The video starts with an aerial view of a wide valley with a river winding through it. Video voiceover.
This is the southern part of the province of Tath. Archaeological findings indicate that our ancestors inhabited this area for 600,000 years. Fish and game were plentiful, and the river provided a reliable water source. At that time, harvesters lived in small family groups, with one adult male, one or more adult females, and numerous offspring. The males and females hunted for food, consisting of fish, mammals, and smaller reptiles. The females were the more productive hunters because the males spent much of their time and energy protecting their territory from other males. Life was straightforward in those days. Hunting, eating, mating, fighting, and raising children. The laws of the hunt governed their lives.
Video zoomed in to show a male reptile with orange scales, small front legs, and a long tail. He was watching a smaller and brighter orange version of himself.
Son, what are you doing?
Asked the larger reptile.
Just playing, Dad.
The father looked down at a small furry mammal on the ground. The mammal, still alive, was trying to escape by pulling itself forward with its front paws. Twin trails of blood led to its back legs, which had been pulled off.
Whack!
The father hit his son with a sweeping blow of his tail. It was a measured hit, just enough to knock the boy slightly off balance.
Kill it and eat it now,
commanded the father.
Dad, I'm not hungry.
Son, we are harvesters. We eat what we kill. Pick it up and put it in your mouth.
The boy picked up the mammal and put it in his mouth.
Legs too.
The boy obeyed, and finished eating the mammal.
"Come over here,"
said the father, motioning to a long, flat rock.
"You are now old enough to know the laws of the hunt."
The father and the son crouched side by side on the rock, their tails stretched out behind them. The rock was near the top of a gentle rise, and they looked out over an expanse of tan grass stretching to the distant mountains. A river snaked through the valley, and large trees with spreading branches grew in clumps along the river. The father said,
"Many years ago, the great hunter ruled our world. He was an incredible beast, the perfect predator. So fast and powerful he could catch and eat anything he wanted. Some say he never missed a kill."
"What did he look like?"
"He was a large mammal, a head taller than me, even though he walked on four legs. His fur was pure black, his eyes yellow, and he could see on the darkest night."
"Where is he now?"
"No one knows. Everything dies, and most people think he got old and died."
"Could he talk?"
"Grandpa said he could talk, but seldom did. There was a time when he became angry with our people. He'd become too good at hunting and killed too many animals. We were killing for fun, not for food."
"What happened?"
"One evening, the great hunter appeared in the middle of a circle at a gathering of elders. The elders were afraid, became quiet. The great hunter looked around the circle and in an angry voice said, 'Fools! You have defiled our planet. Killing is not for fun, it is for survival. If you keep doing what you're doing, we'll all starve.' The great hunter's yellow eyes stared into the eyes of the elders. He said, 'There are two laws, the laws of the hunt, and you will obey them. The first law is to eat what you kill. Killing for fun is stupid and short-sighted. The second law is to be thankful for your prey. They give their lives so that you may live.' Then he said, 'I'll be watching. Those who violate my laws will become my prey.' And he vanished."
"Did everyone obey?"
"The elders saw the wisdom of the laws and said all harvesters should obey them. But four young males laughed at the laws."
"What happened?"
"Two nights later, the severed heads of the four young males were found in the council meeting place. No one saw how they got there. Their bodies were never found. After that, no one laughed."
The boy was silent.
"You've seen me hunt?"
"Yes, Dad."
"What do I do after the kill?"
"You bow your head."
"Right. I am thanking my prey spirit for the gift of its body."
"Do prey have spirits?"
"Yes. Every living thing has a spirit. It's what goes to the afterworld, after death."
"I want to see the great hunter, Dad."
"I'd like to see him too, but only after he has eaten his fill," Jane said.
"These guys don't seem so ferocious." "Ethical carnivores,"
Sarah said. Jane asked,
"Mike, how did the harvesters get from hunting and gathering to interstellar raiding?"
Mike explained, "Over the last half million years, they followed the typical path of intelligent tribal species. Small villages grew into cities, and cities combined into nations. As is the case with many intelligent predatory species, like humans, after they became the dominant species, they began to war amongst themselves. However, the harvesters were able to stop short of self-destruction. We believe it was because the scientists invented a fusion drive, making space travel practical. Instead of killing each other, they returned to hunting and gathering. Except now, they hunt for the resources of other planets and enslave other species to serve the Empire," Jane said.
"This seems oddly familiar, like
colonialism in human history. Conquer and exploit. Sarah said,
And the Earth is the next planet to be exploited. I wish we had some intense, tribal, and violently aggressive males to defend our territory.
Sarah, that hurts.
Sorry, Jane. I mean, we did it together. We could have changed the men or waited for them to destroy us.
And we didn't know the harvesters were coming, but that doesn't help. Feeling responsible.
We both feel responsible. Mike does too,
said Sarah.
Thanks to Mike, we have 50 years to prepare. Maybe with his help, we can defend ourselves.
The harvesters have been conquering planets for thousands of years.
And our men are no longer warriors,
Sarah said.
We're up against an overwhelming enemy.
The two women were silent for a while, each wondering what could be done to defend the Earth. Finally, Sarah said,
Maybe we can use our strengths.
Jane looked puzzled.
Compared to the harvesters, what strengths?
We're geneticists. Maybe we could create mutant warriors with superpowers or develop bioweapons to infect the harvesters with horrible diseases.
Sarah sounded ready to take on the harvesters herself. Jane laughed and said,
That sounds more like a sci-fi movie than a defense strategy. I hope Mike has some ideas for us.
And that was episode 6, everyone. Sure was a ton of stuff to happen. Planet went peaceful, wars went just about extinct, and everything seemed right with the world. Bart retired, which was just fine by him. Mr. Mathias passed away, unfortunately. But Jane became the new head of the Institute, which was terrific for her. And Walt and Sarah got married and had twins. Some damn smart girls they were turning out to be. It's going to be really exciting seeing how they develop. And as for Mike, he got some even worse news. Thankfully, Ellisbach didn't find out what he did. But the news that the harvesters were coming and would be there in around 60 years was far worse. At least he'd have the time to help out the humans a bit before the harvesters arrive. And Jane and Sarah finally get to meet Mike. Though it'll be a couple of more days for them before that happens. Oh well, we'll all find out about it soon enough. Next episode will come out fairly soon. So until we meet again, farewell.
If you'd like to share your thoughts about the show, you have many ways to do so. You can send your feedback in text or audio to thegreathuntersnovel@gmail.com, and I'll be happy to read them or play them before the credits. You can also submit it to the website at www.kaufmansci-fi.com. Facebook page for the podcast and myself is www.facebook.com/performer.andrew.kaufman. If you like the book, please leave a review at Apple Podcasts and or podchaser.com. It really helps people to find the show. That's all for now. I'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode. The book is copywritten 2024 by Gary Kaufman. The intro song is Jet Fueled Vixen by Kevin MacLeod from Incompetech.com. and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 license. The outro song is Stay the Course, also by Kevin MacLeod from Incompetech.com, and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. Contents of this podcast are copywritten 2024 by Andrew Kaufman, and is released on a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. So don't change or sell it, but you can share it all you want. For more information about these licenses, please visit creativecommons.org.